Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, today's episode is all about the next phase for the alternative protein industry. With the vast growth in the consumption of animal protein in the 20th century, came equally vast ecological problems with land use, water use, and huge CO2 equivalent emissions. The livestock sector is a significant contributor to climate change. But one remarkable way in which the food industry has innovated to address this problem is the explosion of the alternative protein sector, with lab-grown meat, plant-based products, algae protein, and precision fermentation. This has been one of the most vibrant and downright fascinating food stories of the past few years. But the challenge remains huge. There are concerns that we don't have enough scientists or alternative protein solutions to meet future demand and to address climate challenges. So today we're going to ask how the alternative protein sector can be turbocharged. What will it take to get to the next phase of growth, and what are the challenges facing it? And I'm joined by Amy Huang, Associate Director of Science and Technology at the Good Food Institute. Hello, Amy. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Now, before we really pull this apart, can you tell me a little bit about the Good Food Institute and about your role in it?
Yes, absolutely. So as you so eloquently cited already, it's becoming a growing part of the collective public consciousness that industrial animal agriculture lies at the intersection of some of the most pressing problems we're up against as a species. Whether we're talking about climate change and environmental devastation or biosecurity risk due to the rising threat of zoonotic disease transmission and the overuse of antibiotics in raising livestock, and the gross inefficient use of planetary resources like land and water that unfolds when you funnel the vast majority of the food you grow to feed animals that then in turn produce a relatively paltry amount of food on the other end for human consumption. And with all of these pressures really being exacerbated by a growing global population. But despite the fact that there has been this growing awareness around the ecological and planetary costs of conventional meat production, meat demand is skyrocketing. It's been skyrocketing, and we anticipate that it will continue to have no signs of slowing down as the global population continues to grow. So the Good Food Institute was a nonprofit organization born out of a new theory of change, of contending with this question of how to transform our relationship to meat. Rather than trying to convince people to eat less meat, our theory was, let's work with the human psychology and give people the meat they love, meat that tastes the same or better, costs the same or less than its conventional counterparts, is as convenient and accessible or more so, but made in a fundamentally different and better way with plants, microorganisms, and animal cells. So we're talking about alternative proteins. And GFI is a nonprofit organization that's essentially focused on architecting this modern protein supply. We work with scientists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, the biggest food and meat companies in the world, universities, and other innovators to do what's needed to advance the alternative protein field. Within GFI, I'm the Associate Director of Science and Technology, and my focus is really on working with universities to both accelerate the pace of technological progress and train the future food workforce. So you can really think of me as working on the people side of an emerging field of research where alt proteins is just an idea, a really dazzling idea, unless you have the people, the scientists and engineers and operators and technicians that are really the backbone of creating a new paradigm for feeding the world.
So if we just step away from the concept of alternative protein for a second and look at the sector as a whole globally, I mean, there are still skeptics about whether or not it can make an impact. It's got still got a long way to go if it's going to make an impact on climate change. But what do you see, if you look at the sector as a whole, what do you see as its strengths and its weaknesses?
I love this question because you're right that alternative proteins is not yet a success story. I think there's been a lot of tremendously exciting progress, but it's certainly not inevitable that we will create a food system where alternative proteins are our first and no longer alternative. So there's a great deal of work to be done by scientists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and other innovators. And that's why an organization like GFI exists, to basically take a bird's eye view and assess where we are today and where we need to be 20 or 30 or 40 or 100 years from now in order to really be feeding the world with these novel food technologies. And then we mobilize the critical stakeholders around the questions that need solving so that we can get to a tipping point where alt proteins are inevitable. And so I would say that when it comes to the central bottleneck of this sector, it really comes down to the lack of funding. It's really a field that is neglected, despite the fact that on the daily, you'll read a new news article talking about a historic funding round for a cultivated meat company. When you actually take a look at the amount of investment and public research funding dollars that have gone into investing into alternative protein research and development, you'll see that it's really a drop in the bucket compared to the resources that are being funneled towards other important solutions to the climate picture, like clean energy. So just to give an example there, industrial animal ag accounts for roughly 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions, which is roughly half of the global greenhouse gases produced by the energy sector. But food system transformation has received orders of magnitude less research funding than its clean energy counterpart, which is all to say that I think one central weakness right now is a lack of kind of mobilization of research funding put towards building a more sustainable food system that is a necessary piece of this climate picture.
It's really interesting you say that, because I think you're right. We read lots of headlines about a new processing plant for alternative proteins coming out, and it gets the headlines. But you're right. It's not a flow of money that's on a scale big enough to really achieve it yet. How about things like the other areas? So cash is one area. And what about other gaps? So knowledge, education, is there a lack of collaboration? I mean, you're particularly concerned about spreading the knowledge to universities and I guess that is to get students enthused by the whole sector. What's the state of play in that kind of area right now?
There's a real kind of lack of understanding, I think, overall, that these types of innovations, taking a technological breakthrough to the point where it's commercialized and on the table in front of consumers, across sectors, innovation is really a decades-long project. And so even though we are making research breakthroughs on the daily, there's a lot of capital, a lot of infrastructure development that it will take to actually get that on the table in front of the people that we're trying to feed. So in the spirit of your question, what are some of the, you know, major gaps that still exist here? Absolutely, I think awareness is a big part of that. I think there are many scientists and engineers out there who have the right skill sets to be contributing to this field, and yet they just don't know yet, because this is a new research field that lies at the intersection of so many critical scientific disciplines, and nobody's yet connected the dots. But with awareness comes a real need for training. We need more education and training programs at colleges and universities around the globe that are equipping scientists and engineers with the skills needed to actually advance this field. And I do think a lot of the headlines that you read about, for the most part, are about large strides being made in the private sector when it comes to technological progress. But the truth is, for a lot of the technologies we're working with here, we're in a pre-competitive phase where it doesn't even yet make sense for all of these companies to be doing the same amount of, you know, the same research end to end across the supply chain, because a lot of those questions are best investigated in an academic setting. And we need a kind of boost in open access research so that we can kind of advance the whole of human knowledge and lift, you know, all boats by lifting the tide. So yes, awareness, training, funding, all of those things, and a need, I think, to foster more collaboration, more knowledge sharing through open access research.
I'm also interested in the question of why. I mean, it's an expanding area. There's a huge amount of potential for it. You know, we do see lots of press about new startups and entering the space and doing new things. So why isn't there money there? I mean, I always love to hear a conspiracy theory that, you know, the global food industry is holding this back because it wants to sell us more beef. But I wonder, is it a question of the different stages? Is it investment at different stages? So there are lots of companies trying out new ideas. Is it the scaling up? Is it creating major production facilities? At what point do you see the bottleneck of money, of investment cropping up?
I think, well, across the supply chain, but truly at the center of it, I think is who is funding the foundational scientific and engineering research for this field. And we've started to see a trickle of governmental funding. The Dutch government, for example, just a few months ago announced a historic 60 million euro funding allotment for cultivated meat research. So we're starting to see, you know, governments start to get in on helping build this emerging field.
But again, as you say, that's a lot, but it's a little as well, isn't it?
It is quite a little, yes. And I really do think that energy has been the disproportionate part of the climate change conversation. Part of what we need to do here is make very clear that alternative proteins is a critical climate solution, that food systems are a major source of global greenhouse gases. And then to kind of fund these technological solutions in proportion to their contribution to these challenges. So I do think what this needs to do is enter the public discourse. And we do need to mobilize individuals and institutions around the world to prioritize alternative proteins so that it can kind of receive the appropriate amount of funding.
Yeah. Okay, so if we look at the education sector itself, or academia, how many institutions offer specific courses in alternative proteins? I mean, I guess there's a whole vast amount of different skills that are needed. There's biochemistry, there's engineering, things like that. But how many courses which really feed into the alternative protein industry are there? Is it becoming more commonplace?
Definitely depends on how rigorously you're defining alternative protein courses. Mm. But I would ballpark that there are around 20 courses at universities around the world that really touch on the science of alternative proteins. One of the big hotspots for alt protein education that we're seeing is Tufts University, for example, where Dr. David Kaplan is running a course on the science of cellular agriculture, and they've just launched a graduate certificate in cellular agriculture as well. So we are starting to see a growing number of institutions that are seeing the need for alt protein education, mostly in response to student demand.
Mm. Now, I'm interested in how you go about it, because this is part of your role today. Now, how do you go about convincing universities to start thinking about setting up an alternative protein focused course? I mean, they're such a law unto themselves. You know, it must be hellishly difficult.
That is a framing I quite like. Hellishly difficult. There are so many white spaces in this field. And I think one of the biggest ones is the need for academic institutions to embrace alt protein research and education. And like you've noted, universities are quite a beast. They are some of the most powerful institutions in our economy, but they're also, in many ways, like operating as large corporations.
Yeah, they got to flog a course, haven't they?
yes, moving away from open access, truly open access research. But that's all to say that we need passionate educators and we need forward-thinking university administrators and brilliant students and scientists that are putting their brains together to accelerate the state of tech in this field, both from the basic science perspective and from the perspective of training the people who will be the backbone of this industry. And so when I first started in this role trying to tackle this problem space, I did a lot of cold emailing. I did a lot of knocking on doors and trying to get universities to listen. But what I noticed is that universities were far more receptive to actors within the academic institution than kind of strangers from an external entity trying to tell them what to study and what to research. And in fact, many of the kind of pioneers in alt protein science started in this field because their students said that this was a field of research they were interested in. And so this kind of got me thinking around, you know, who better to really shift institutional priorities than the customers of these academic institutions who are our students. So in February of 2020, we launched the Alt Protein Project around this hypothesis that centering students in this quest to transform universities and transform the food system was going to be the most tractable path forward. So we built the Alt Protein Project, which is a program that finds and trains and empowers students at key research universities around the globe to advocate for alternative protein research and education and really build that infrastructure, in addition to forming a pipeline of trained professionals for the industry. And we're seeing kind of them do exactly that.
So this is fascinating. Can you? So it's the Good Food Institute's alt protein project, or do you call it the alternative protein project?
We call it the alt protein project, but only.
I like that. No, it's good. It's good. Very alt J. So in practical terms, how does it work?
Our goals are to, on one hand, create a steady, easily identifiable stream of talent to flow into the alt protein field, which means that we need more of these education and training programs, also trying to accelerate the scientific progress being made. So we need more open access research. So what this really means is that we're mobilizing students to reach out to professors who are either teaching courses that are relevant to alternative proteins or doing research for which alternative proteins would be a natural application, and building relationships, connecting them with a community of other scientists and researchers, and advocating, really working with them to get this foundational infrastructure set up. So we find students at universities around the world, or rather, oftentimes they find us, and we work to kind of train them with the foundational leadership skills and the how-to models for how we get these courses set up, which often looks, when you zoom in on the day-to-day, not that glamorous, right? When you're talking about architecting a new field, some of that is hosting flashy talks and you know, chatting with some of the coolest people in the alternative protein sector. But a lot of that is emailing people that you want to have be an active member of this field and working with them to help them understand how their existing field of research is relevant to this new opportunity.
Giving them a platform in many ways. Now, The concept of open access research is a constant thorn in my side, because it just seems crazy that government funded research isn't published and isn't available to everyone. But also, I guess this is an industry with money, it's at the early stages of innovation. You've got startups, so I guess people are jealously guarding their material. I mean, how do you crack that? How do you make research open access instead of owned by companies and institutions?
I think despite the fact that I'm all for open access research, I do think private research has its place. And all of the kind of commercial strides we've been making in the private sector make sense. And they've been, valuable steps forward in this quest to build a new way of feeding people. And I think that we have mechanisms for open access research. Public research funding by governments exists for this reason. And it just isn't being effectively mobilized for the alternative protein field yet. But GFI is open access everything. We're very supportive of folks who, and we give a platform to folks who want to kind of dive deep into the technical basis of their research findings and share that with the rest of the world. And we also have a research grants program to fund research. We give away about $5 million of open access research every year, which again is the tiniest grain of salt in what needs to be a real mountain of salt of research funding for this field. But I think you're also touching upon the need for democratizing knowledge. And I do think a big part of that is building capacity in places that have historically been left out of the food systems conversation. So low and middle income countries, minority serving institutions, all critical underrepresented voices for helping us understand how to build a food system that is truly more sustainable. And an important thing that I want to underscore here is that our theory of change, of using markets and technologies to build a better food system, that theory of change only works if these products are actually made accessible, right? If the products we're creating are culturally relevant, if they are cost accessible, and if the infrastructure is built in the places where we're seeing the largest streaks of population growth and will continue to see the greatest rise in population growth.
That makes a lot of sense. And now, across the sector, where would you say the blank spots are? I mean, are there sectors within alternative protein which people aren't going into, or because the technology or the knowledge isn't there, or the funding isn't there? Are there specific areas where you feel that it's just not quite performing well enough?
Opportunities really exist across production platforms. So what we haven't yet done, you did this a little bit in the beginning, but when we talk about alternative proteins, we're talking about plant-based, cultivated, and fermentation technologies. That's meat, eggs, dairy created by kind of recapitulating the sensory experience of conventional meat and using plants, microorganisms, and animal stem cells as inputs. And really, across each of these three core production platforms, there are so many technological strides that need to be made. For cultivated meat, for example, we think the biggest barrier to cost parity is going to be in terms of media formulation. The nutrient media that's used to feed stem cells that then grow and seed onto scaffolding and grow into three-dimensional cuts of meat. And the real need to make media that is food grade rather than pharmaceutical grade so that it is at a cost that makes sense as an input into very high volume, low margin industry like meat production, rather than very low volume, high margin industries like the biopharmaceutical space. And so there is I would rattle off the many, many research questions that we see a lack of focus in. But I think on the plant-based side, for example, there's also, people think like plant-based must be mostly there. I think that's a really common misconception, because what we do see a lot of are really convincing plant-based burgers and sausages and chicken nuggets. What we're not seeing as much of are sophisticated cuts of meat, like fish fillets and chicken breasts and T-bone steaks. And that's what people eat. So I think there's a real need for advancement when it comes to food protein texturization and manufacturing. So currently, the extruder is the primary piece of machinery that's used to produce plant-based meat. But there are many other production methods being explored, like 3D printing or shear cell technology, that are much earlier on in the development process. But there's also a need to explore the very raw materials that we use to produce plant-based meat. We see soy and wheat and pea really taking the spotlight here, but we have barely scratched the surface of what is possible in the plant kingdom. And all of those raw materials are really just byproducts of other industries. We haven't selected them because they're best for a plant-based meat application. And so that's all to say there are these foundational science questions in the plant-based realm as well that are needed to be answered if we're really going to make, you know, these paradigm shifts rather than incremental steps in innovation here.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, you're perfectly placed to see what's going on in lots of different areas, and especially at the starting point, both in academia and in the production of alternative proteins. So I wondered, could you choose two or three projects that really excite you at the moment? And that's not necessarily the biggest ones. Maybe it's something that you're just fascinated by, or you find it really tickles you in some kind of way. What really excites you right now?
Yeah, something that I can't name two or three, but I will tell you 20 projects. we have 20 new student groups at universities across the globe that we've just invited into our community, into our program. These student groups span 18 countries across 5 continents, and we're really starting to see, you know, including our first groups in Asia and Africa and Australia, joining the ranks of groups who we've already established in Europe and the US. And so what I'm most excited about is watching the incredible strides these 20 new projects, these 20 new student groups make in the cascading months and years. Because what we've seen to date is, I told you about how we started the Alt Protein Project just on a hunch, on trying to see if the hypothesis that students could really change our food system, if there was any weight in that. And what we're finding is that it's kind of a resounding, emphatic yes. We've seen most of the courses that we're seeing in the world were driven by students of the Alt Protein Project. At UNC Chapel Hill, at Stanford University, at UC Davis, at Johns Hopkins University, we've seen students successfully set up courses that focus on alternative proteins and focus on training their peers to have a career in this field. And we've also seen these same student groups inspire researchers around the globe to pursue alt protein research where they would otherwise not have given it a thought, and influenced dozens of research proposals to making strides in alt protein technologies. So I'm just so excited about these 20 new projects and excited to follow their progress as it unfolds.
Can you give us a flavor of a few of these 20?
Sure, yeah. We have new groups at the University of Nigeria, the University of Melbourne. We're working with EIT Food, which is a really incredible institution that spans 7 universities. Their Masters of Food Systems span 7 universities in Europe. We also, have new groups within the United States at San Diego State University, which is a Hispanic serving institution, and we really hope to have more minority and serving institutions, whether tribal colleges and universities, historically Black universities and colleges, or Hispanic serving institutions, be a part of our program in future expansion waves.
And just a little detail here, I'm just interested, which departments do you normally find these courses in? Are we looking at bioengineering? Are we looking at food technology departments? Where are they normally found?
These courses are being built largely from scratch, although our student groups definitely also work to incorporate modules into existing courses, like the ones you've kind of listed. An intro to bioengineering course, for example, would be the perfect place to have a whole module on the science of cultivated meat. But we work across disciplines. So these courses, the 20 or so courses that we're aware of, are sometimes housed in food science, sometimes housed in the tissue engineering department, sometimes housed at the introductory undergraduate level as just a seminar course, for example, for students who are interested in exploring all sorts of different ways to apply alt proteins to their career, whether as a policymaker or as an entrepreneur or as a scientist. So there really is a broad spread, chemical engineering, a really broad spread of key scientific and engineering disciplines.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got an extraordinary enthusiasm for this, so it's very infectious. I can imagine lots more of them cropping up as well. Now, last question for you, which is slightly off the topic, and it's very much about your own opinion on something. I wondered, do you think that we'll look back in the year 2050, or you will look back, and well, no, all of us look back at the consumption of animal products in today's world and say, what were we thinking? Did we really do that? A bit like in the way that we see smoking now.
I do think one day in the future we will look back and think, why did we ever, create or rather raise animals for their parts? But I don't know that it'll happen in 2050. I think if there's anything I've learned, technological progress unfolds a lot more quickly than kind of behavioral progress in many ways or changes to the human philosophy. But I'm really optimistic that we'll get there, and we'll get there by making alternative proteins, making the default, the easiest option for people to eat, also the most ethical and sustainable option. So I am often on my high horse about how human brains are fallible. Human brains, and the reason I entered this field is because I know human brains are badly broken at many things. And one of those things is attributing salience and consideration to the things that most warrant them. We are kind of hardwired biologically to preference those closest to us, whether we're talking about people who look like us or people who are kind of geographically in proximity to us, or human animals as opposed to non-human animals that have larger differences. And this kind of myopia, I think, keeps us from accurately prioritizing the people and the places that most warrant our attention. So I'm really optimistic that alternative proteins will allow us to build a kinder, brighter future, not just for the people who exist in Western industrialized nations where, I can see them, but also the people halfway across the world who deserve to have nutritious food on the table, but are kind of far out of sight and deserve to have a habitable planet. And also for the non-human animals who deserve humane living conditions and ecological environments and habitats that are well preserved. And also the people of the future who I will never meet and you will never meet, who deserve a habitable planet for centuries to come. I think all of these layers of distance can be broken down, and alt proteins is no silver bullet, but I think it does get us closer to a place where we are prioritizing the groups that we ought to be prioritizing.
Well, that was beautifully put, and it's been a complete joy speaking to you. Your enthusiasm is wildly infectious. So, Amy Huang, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Steph. This was a pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Food Matters Live podcast on your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.